bad lines. Israeli authorities approve the construction of more than 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. Cuba's president again blames the United States for the anti-government protests in his country as he calls for calm following several days of civil unrest. And floods and heavy rain in western Germany leave at least 6 people dead and dozens of others missing. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Israel's new prime minister has relaunched a controversial project for the construction of over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves the construction of an unbuilt area of the occupied land. It cuts land access between Palestinian inhabited territories in the West Bank, rendering any future unified Palestinian state unviable. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also tried to advance the project, but it was halted under pressure from the international community, the Palestinian Authority, and rights groups. The project is also expected to draw objections from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's left-wing coalition partners, as well as the U.S. All Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Mona Kandil has given us more details on the new Israeli settlement project in the occupied West Bank.
Those 3,412 new settler units would be built in the occupied West Bank, mainly in one of the biggest Israeli settlements known as Ma'ale Adonim. These settlements are part of the E1 project that would be linking some West Bank cities with East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, allowing settlers to move freely from the Ma'ale Adonim settlement and the settlements around it to inside Jerusalem, Al-Quds, however, separating Palestinian villages and towns and cities. It would be separating the central of the occupied West Bank from northern the occupied West Bank. And this, of course, would be very difficult for the Palestinians. According to experts and anti-settlement groups, what we have read this morning, that this might lead to a new conflict or a possible conflict between the American administration and the Israeli regime, because it seems that the U.S. administration is trying to convince the Israelis not to declare about major settlement projects that would be bringing some problems, whether to the Israeli regime and to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett himself.
The Cuban president has called for peace, harmony, and respect amid anti-government protests across the nation.
To overcome disagreements between all of us, we have to encourage each other to try and find solutions, even if we sometimes have different points of view on certain issues or different situations.
Miguel Diaz-Canel once again blamed the United States for the anti-government protests over the economic downturn in his country. Havana says economic crisis has been caused by a half a century of Washington's sanctions and embargo. Meanwhile, Cuba restored internet access and temporarily lifted restrictions on the amount of food and medicine that travelers could bring into the country. The moves were an apparent concession to demands by protesters who took to the streets last weekend. One person has died and more than 100 have been arrested in the anti-government protests so far. Writer and anti-imperialist activist Bambose Shango says Cuban people have stood firm against the U.S. sanctions and embargo, as well as plots to bring about a regime change in their country.
The United States have, of course, had an over 60-year embargo on the Cuban people that have stifled their development. Even with this embargo, the Cuban people have been very resilient and have done amazing things that it's hard to perceive how under such a cold-blooded embargo people are able to even survive. The recent embargo, including the addition of over 400 more strangulations placed on Cuba by the Trump administration and has not been removed by the Biden administration has caused hunger and suffering, great shortage of everything from food to medicine to gasoline, and the people are under pressure. Of course, the U.S. in its war against Cuba, its regime change war, has used this pressure to stir inside of Cuba controversies that would possibly lead to what they hope would be a change of government.
At least six people have been killed in western Germany after several houses collapsed following heavy rains and severe flooding. Police say more than 30 people have also gone missing. They say at least half a dozen houses have been washed away by raging torrents. And a two dozen more are at the risk of collapse. Two firefighters drowned on Wednesday trying to help those stranded in the floods. That's according to the police. Severe flooding has disrupted rail, road, and river transport, leaving many areas cut off in the region. Shipping has also been suspended on the Rhine River. The army has been deployed to help with rescue operations. Evacuation orders have been issued for parts of the region. The German Weather Service has forecast more heavy rains for the next 2 days. Well, the swift spread of the COVID-19 Delta variant across Europe and the United States has led to a surge in infections. Restrictive measures are now being reintroduced to contain the spread. During our news review program, we discuss the issue. Let's take a look.
Welcome, everyone, to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Coronavirus infections are on the rise in Europe and the U.S., with the highly transmissible Delta variant contributing significantly to the recent surge. Spain has reported more than 43,000 new cases. Spanish northeastern region of Catalonia, a hotbed of the Delta variant, has now reintroduced restrictions and curfews in an attempt to contain the virus spread. UK has reported 50 new coronavirus fatalities, highest daily death toll since April. A number of new daily cases is also topped 30,000 for a seventh consecutive day now. In the world's worst hit country, the U.S., the rate of new cases has seen at least a 10% hike in 46 states. Some states have even seen a 50% jump in number of infections in the past week. And now joining us for the program is Jerome Hughes out of Brussels and Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, hope you're safe and doing well, both of you. I guess we'll start over there in the States with you, Colin, if you could. The latest, please.
Yeah, as we see, the variant is traveling across the United States. We're starting to see a rise in many of the states across the contiguous United States with a rise in COVID-19 cases. And what health experts are advising people is you can have it both ways of trying to remain unmasked or not getting vaccinated. It has to be one or the other. And while some are reluctant to get vaccinated, we're seeing the number of cases of people who have contracted COVID-19. What health experts are saying is a majority of those people are unvaccinated people. Now, as we know, the president has rolled out an aggressive regimen of trying to get people vaccinated with either Moderna, Pfizer, or Johnson & Johnson shots. He came a little bit short of his overall goal, but the surge did get a lot of people vaccinated. But there still seems to be a chasm, the amount of people that still need to be vaccinated in order for COVID-19 to remain contained.
Thank you, Colin and Jerome. I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Brussels. How are things over there in the European Union?
Daniel, the situation is that, you know, you have a situation whereby the health experts are saying that, you know, none of these vaccines are 100% effective. So that means that people with serious conditions, even if they're fully vaccinated, they can still die. Also, the vast majority of young people have not been fully vaccinated. And that means that young people can get a mild condition with coronavirus, but then go on to develop long COVID. which has all sorts of very dangerous implications, even for young people, this long COVID. And also, when young people are not vaccinated, it means that you can have more and more people transmitting the virus onto somebody else, and that gives the potential rise for variants, and potentially variants that could be resistant to the vaccines that we have. And that's why the health experts are saying we need as many people to be vaccinated as possible. We have the very latest data tonight coming out in terms of the latest cases and numbers. In the UK, more than 42,000 additional cases. Spain, more than 26,000. France, almost 9,000. Netherlands, 10,000. And Portugal, more than 4,000. And I mean, Portugal's a good example. Just a few weeks ago, they were talking about 200 cases, 300 cases. Then you remember they had the Champions League final in Lisbon, so you had a lot of people coming over from the UK, where the Delta variant was spreading rapidly in the UK, and now it's spreading in the European Union, and you see that in Portugal. Also, you know, Belgium is a good example. Okay, in the last 24-hour period, we've had just 1,300 additional cases, but actually, for weeks and weeks and weeks, it was like only 300 cases, 400 cases, 500 cases. So now it's consistently over the last few days over 1,000 cases, and if that spiral keeps going up, you have to ask the question, where is it going to end? The other side of it, though, is you see there's a political dimension to this, Daniel, as well. Mm. There's a lot of pressure of politicians, because you mentioned the protests in Paris, protests in Athens, and that's because people are saying this is a civil liberties issue, that you cannot force us to take the vaccines. You cannot say the only way you can have indoor dining, for example, is if you take the vaccines. But that's what Emmanuel Macron is saying, and that's why you're seeing resistance and you're seeing, you know, skirmishes on the streets of Paris between the police and people who feel that a gun is being put against their head to take the vaccines. So it's a balance between, as usual, as since the start of this pandemic, it's a balance between the health side of things and also the pressure, the political pressure, because the vast majority, of course, almost everyone, they're so reluctant to go back to the lockdowns that we've had previously. They're just not willing to allow that to happen. But as we get more and more cases and the transmission rate goes up, more people are going into hospital. Look at Ireland, for example. It's the only country in the EU that has such tough restrictions at the moment in Ireland. But actually, cases are going up there as well because there's an open border with the UK. So you have the Delta variant coming in. And so they're seeing a rise in hospital admissions. And it's a country with a terrible health system. They already have overwhelmed health system there in terms of overcrowding in hospitals. So they can't handle a pandemic in Ireland. And that's why, you know, this is a big concern, that even though we're getting more and more people vaccinated, just there are not enough people vaccinated. And particularly it's a problem with young people.
Gentlemen, thank you both. Stay safe, both of you. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels and Colin Campbell joining us out of Washington, D.C. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Australia's second populous state, Victoria, is set to enter a lockdown to combat rising number of coronavirus infections. Authorities said Melbourne and its surrounding areas would be placed under restriction for 5 days starting from late Thursday. This will bring the total number of Australians under stay-at-home orders to around 12 million. The decision was made after Victoria recorded 18 new infections, largely blamed on the Delta variant. Sydney, the capital of New South Wales state, is already under lockdown for 14 days. Australia has previously controlled sporadic flare-ups of infections through lockdown, speedy contact tracing, and tough social distancing measures. The country has so far reported a total of over 31,000 cases and over 900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Clashes have erupted between French riot police and anti-vaccination protesters in the capital, Paris. The demonstrators are voicing their anger at President Emmanuel Macron's COVID-19 plan, which will be put in effect next month. The plan will require a vaccine certificate or a negative test to grant access to public places, including restaurants and cinemas. A similar protest was held in the Greek capital, Athens. The Greek government announced Tuesday that the people will need to be vaccinated to be granted access to indoor public places. The country has also required all health workers to be inoculated against the virus. A protest against the renewal of an anti-migration deal between Italy and Libya has been held in front of the Parliament building in Rome. NGOs say the deal confirms Italy's complicity in torture of refugees. Let's have a look.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian Parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times. Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Health tourism. In the name of God, salam, and welcome to the second episode of our series, Health Tourism. In the last episode, we discussed various types of tourism and learned that medical tourism is one form of tourism which is growing significantly year after year. Many people travel to other countries with the aim of receiving quality medical services at a cheaper and more reasonable cost than they would at home. Please stay with us for a more detailed discussion of medical tourism. Health tourism is the result of combining two profitable industries, that is, travel and medical industries. Therefore, this kind of tourism also includes a variety of subcategories, such as medical tourism, curative tourism, and wellness tourism. All of them are named based on patients' needs. Considering a variety of definitions with regard to health tourism, we tend to mention all as health tourism, and our focus will be mainly on familiarizing patients with medical centers and services provided in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In order to increase their revenues, many countries all around the world are keen to offer medical services. However, due to the critical nature of this field and the lack of required medical infrastructure and experienced professionals, not all countries are able to do so. Among all countries, Iran is considered one of the best in offering medical services to foreign nationals. Benefiting from various eye-catching historical sites and stunning nature, the country attracts a huge number of tourists who come to enjoy Iran's tourist attractions every year. According to reports, Iran ranks 10th globally on the list of world's historical sites and 5th in terms of natural attractions. Besides that, Iran has become one of the pioneering countries in the region and the world thanks to its scientific development in the field of medicine, excellent and highly trained doctors, as well as utilizing state-of-the-art facilities, which has made this country a popular destination for medical tourists, especially those tourists and patients who visit Iran from neighboring countries. Nowadays, many patients from regional countries such as Kuwait, Qatar, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and so on, prefer to travel to Iran instead of European countries to get medical services. The close distance between Iran and neighboring countries enables patients to go back in a short time after receiving excellent treatments from Iranian professionals and doctors and their brilliant expertise. Another reason is the reasonable cost of treatment in Iran that has made this country a popular destination for patients. The special attention from Iran's neighboring countries, as well as Iranian doctors' expertise and qualifications, has encouraged Iran's health ministry to launch a special department called Department of Health Tourism of Ministry of Health to facilitate health tourism for those in need and adopt rules and regulations for hospitals admitting foreign patients. According to these regulations, hospitals, clinics, and other medical centers with foreign applicants are required to launch International Patient Department, or IPD. Otherwise, they are not allowed to admit foreign patients unless in emergency situation. Medical centers with IPD permit are required to follow related instructions. Those hospitals with IPD permit should undertake few tasks, such as doing needed coordination for admitting patients, accompanying them during their stay in Iran, offering medical services and recovery cures after their surgery, and all sort of services patients need throughout their stay in the country. The IPD staff are responsible for responding patients' application and contacting them via phone and email and holding conference with their attending physician. Patients can easily contact IPD of each hospital to know more about the costs and services of treatment they offer beforehand. Also, the IPD staff are in charge of doing essential coordination with doctors and hospitals, coordination with surgery rooms, care unit, discharge and finance units. Currently, there are more than 150 hospitals and medical centers in Tehran and other Iranian cities with a special permit for treating foreign patients. Iran is one of the countries in the world with high expertise in treating cardiovascular diseases, infertility, ophthalmic and neurological disorders, as well as treating different cancers. Iran also benefits from a high reputation in the region in the field of plastic surgery. Also, the country ranks first in Asia and third in the world in kidney transplant with laparoscopy, and according to a 2019 report, ranks first in the world in liver transplant. Iranian optometrists are among high-ranking experts in the world, and the facilities being utilized in some optometry centers in Iran are the best ones that are being used in only few countries in the world. Most of the foreign patients in Iranian hospitals have been respectively admitted for female diseases, cardiovascular diseases, nose job, eye surgery, and general surgeries. The Iranian cities of Tehran, Qom, Mashhad, Ahvaz, Urumiye, and Shiraz have received most of the foreign patients. Patients and medical tourists can receive more information about hospitals and medical centers with IPD permit in various ways. One of them is the Iran Ministry of Health Medical Tourism Department. Its website is iht.en.behdasht.gov.ir. By a quick browse in this website, you can get information you need about the hospital and medical centers in Iran with IPD permit, the rules and regulations, as well as tourism in Iran and Iranian hotels in different languages. Iran's health ministry has also announced that it will issue permits to those qualified tourism centers and institutes that are willing to work in the field of health tourism. These centers are ready to offer various types of services to medical tourists, and they can trustfully assign these centers the coordination job with the hospitals and let them reserve the hotel. To know more about these centers and institutes, the applicants can easily go to Iran's Health Ministry website. Also, many of these institutes have branches in many countries where the patients can ask them for more information in person. Dear listeners, this was the second episode of our program, Health Tourism. In the next episode, we will introduce one of reputable optometry hospitals in the Iranian capital, Tehran, called Farabi Hospital. Till next program, goodbye. the spotlight.
It is the anniversary of the Iran nuclear deal, otherwise known as the JCPOA, but it is not a time to celebrate. After weeks of talks in Vienna, the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions, as Iran has demanded. This not only jeopardizes the outcome of the talks, but leads Iran to conclude that the U.S., headed by President Joe Biden, still believes the maximum pressure campaign actually works.
It was July 14, 2015, that Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the US, France, Britain, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The agreement was later endorsed by the United Nations Security Council with Resolution 2231. Based on the accord signed during the administration of then-U.S. President Barack Obama, Iran undertook to put limits on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of nuclear-related sanctions imposed on the country. Following the enforcement of the pact in January 2016, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed for 15 times in its reports, in a span over 3 years, that Tehran fully implemented its commitments under the deal. But in May 2018, Obama's successor, Donald Trump, unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which spotlighted Tehran's mistrust of Washington. 1 year after Washington's pullout of the JCPOA, Iran began to roll back its commitments as the remaining signatories failed to secure its interests under the deal. Nonetheless, the administration of Joe Biden expressed readiness to re-enter the JCPOA, which paved the way for Iran and the remaining signatories to hold several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital to revive the deal. Iran has stressed that the deal cannot be revived unless the U.S. removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. It has also insisted on a guarantee by the U.S. to not renege on the accord again in the future. Despite the Biden administration's willingness to restore the JCPOA, it has taken no concrete measures to that direction so far. Now, on the sixth signing anniversary of the landmark agreement, Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue its pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse its course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joins us from Budapest. Also joining us, political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran, Sayed Mohammad Mirandi, who joins us. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me start with you, Professor Mirandi, if I may. We're looking at the JCPOA anniversary, which should be a joyous occasion, but the U.S. pulled out of the deal. It has incurred billions of dollars of damage to Iran's economy. So this, in a sense, should be a day where the U.S. should be held responsible to pay for these damages. What are your views when you take a look at this anniversary in terms of what it marks and what it signifies?
I think it not only exposes the real nature of the U.S. government, but it also exposes the nature of Western governments, the Western media, the Western political establishment, and that is that none of them can be trusted. The United States, as we speak, continues to impose maximum pressure sanctions. They have no intention so far to implement the nuclear deal, and the Europeans are siding with the Americans, and the Western media behaves as if the United States is not to blame. The United States under Obama, when they signed the deal, they failed even back then to abide by their commitments, and then under Trump they left the deal completely. The maximum pressure campaign, of course, was barbaric under Trump, but we have to also keep in mind that the whole notion of this maximum pressure campaign was Obama's. It was Biden and Obama that began targeting women and children to gain concessions from Iran. And ultimately, when they saw that Iran wouldn't bend the knee. Obama sent a message to Iran basically implying that he'll accept Iran's right to enrich uranium, and then the negotiations began. And then after, of course, President Rouhani won the election, we had a new type of negotiations, the P5 plus one, and Iran, and we had the deal. But the point is that U.S. behavior has been inhumane from the beginning. The United States never abided by its own commitments, whether under Democrats or Republicans. The Iranians did abide by their commitments, yet the Western media continues to depict Iran as the problem. Not only should Western countries be abiding by their commitments right now, but they should be compensating for the deaths and the destruction that has been carried out as a result of their violations over the last few years. Yet what we're seeing instead is Western governments continuing with the maximum pressure campaign so that they can get additional concessions from Iran. They have no intention of implementing the deal in full as we speak, I should stress. And that's something that would, in a sane world, be extraordinary, but for us, it's nothing unexpected.
First time, really, something that many don't recall or that it wasn't highlighted, even though it was very evident, and it became very evident, was back in the time when the deal was signed. Lots of optimism, obviously, because of the signature showing that diplomacy works. But then when it actually came to the execution part, in order for Iran to reap the benefits, it was becoming increasingly clear that that wasn't happening. People were afraid, countries were afraid to invest in Iran because they said at some point or another, the U.S. sanctions would bite. And many of these large companies and conglomerates, well, they had centers or franchises in the U.S. So when the money was to make its way around, they were afraid that somewhere along the line, the U.S. Treasury, for example, would jump on that. So this deal really did not even evolve or to come into fruition for Iran, did it?
That's absolutely right. It was already stated within the JCPOA itself the likelihood of the United States withdrawing. I mean, in other words, it was already envisaged that the United States would one day withdraw, and that's why the other members of the JCPOA made their commitments that if the United States withdraws and reimposes sanctions, they will alleviate the pain that Iran would suffer as a result of their reimposed sanctions. That, of course, never happened. But it's clear that right there, even as they were negotiating, it was always on the cards that the United States would withdraw. And the United States never ratified the JCPOA, and so therefore, it was inevitable that the next man in after Obama would simply walk away, given the extent of the hostility toward Iran that is shared all across the political spectrum in the United States. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump, Donald Trump is a very controversial political figure, to say the least, in the United States. Many of his statements and his policies arouse a lot of rancor in the United States. The one policy that doesn't arouse rancor is his policy toward Iran. Yeah, that's passed, you know, without any problems. His assassination, illegal assassination of General Soleimani, that went by the board. You know, no one objected too much to that. So again, you know, now that we're having these negotiations in Vienna, we've already had six rounds. You know, you look around and say, the Biden administration has no particular political need to do anything for Iran. It has very limited political capital at home. It will only incur unpopularity, obviously, among the Republicans, but it will also incur a considerable amount of unpopularity even among Democrats. So that's why it's essentially been stalling, kicking the can down the road. We've had these six rounds of talks, now we're going to have a seventh round of talk, but it's made no real decision, no real commitment to return to the JCPOA.
Well, not to drag out the past, but Professor Morandi, I need to touch on this because it's rather important the way that the EU through the E3 played its role, which it was very striking the way that the EU had to come out and say, we can't force companies to do business with Iran or not. But they actually came out with a handbook, I think, explaining to these companies that, you know, it's okay to do business. And then they came out with this Instex. But nothing panned out. How do you assess the European role during that time?
I think we first have to go back to the Obama years. And after the signing of the nuclear deal, almost a year after the deal was signed, the head of the Iranian Central Bank said in Washington, if I'm not mistaken, that nothing has changed. In other words, Obama never intended to implement the deal, let alone the EU three countries. They had no intention of doing anything for Iran. They were basically trying to buy time to keep Iran implementing the deal. They knew from the start they weren't going to do anything. After Obama signed the deal, a series of senior banking officials from Europe came to Iran, and they wanted to see me. So they came to my office, and they told me very explicitly that we are very interested in working in Iran. Important banks, if I name them, they're relatively well known. They said, we want to work in Iran, but the Americans have told us through back channels that if you go to Iran, we will punish you. This was after the deal was signed. This was under the Obama regime. This was not during Trump. When Trump left the deal and imposed maximum pressure, the Europeans never intended to do anything about it. All they wanted to do was to keep Iran in the deal, so that on the one hand, the Europeans would be imposing Trump sanctions against Iran, and Iran would be keep its own hands tied. And Iran actually did that for a year, not because the Europeans wanted it, but the Iranians calculated that if they continue to implement the deal for a year or an extended period of time, it would make the United States look very bad. Whereas if the Iranians had left the deal right after the United States, we all know how the Western media works. Iran would be blamed. The Western media would ignore Trump and attack Iran, even though it was obvious that Trump was the problem. So the Iranians waited a year, continued to implement the deal, and then only after a year, in five steps, as you know, every 2 months, Iran began to decrease its commitments. And then after 2 years, almost 2 years, Iran was carrying out minimal commitments, let's say 30-40% of its commitments. It's, you know, debatable. It's subjective how to put a percentage on it. And then only a few months ago, as you recall, as we all recall, that the Iranian parliament passed a law where the Iranians discontinued its implementation of the deal. So the Europeans never intended to abide by the deal. The Americans never intended to abide by the deal. And right now, the Europeans and the Americans do not intend to abide by the deal.
Well, that obviously raises the question, to follow up on what just Professor Morandi said there, George Samiali, then why are the parties hashing out whatever it is that they're hashing out?
Well, I think they want to somehow lock Iran into the deal without their actually making any commitments themselves. And Biden did make a variety of promises during the election. I never took these promises seriously. They always seemed to be hedged and evasive, and people were eager. There were, you know, Washington pundits were absolutely insistent that, oh, Biden will return to the JCPOA. He's absolutely determined to do it. It was always nonsensical. And that he was always extraordinarily invasive. But the point is that by keeping the negotiations going and then nothing would come out of it, it's a way of making sure that Iran will take the blame for any, basically, you know, failure to come to an agreement. Well, we bent backwards. We stretched out our hand. You know, we did what we could. We went the extra mile. But the Iranians were just so absolutely unreasonable. What can you expect? So I think a lot of it is just a lot of play acting in order to provide for the Americans a kind of a face-saving formula.
Well, I do have to bring in what Zarif has said on his Twitter account, and I'd like to get your reaction on this, Professor Morandi, out of respect, if anything. And him saying 6 years ago today, JCPOA received a UNSC Chapter 6 issue without resorting to war. Obama realized his crippling sanctions would not cripple Iran or its centrifuges. Trump ineptly thought maximum pressure would. It never will. I'm sure you've read this tweet by Zarif. What do you think?
It's complicated. I was never for or against the nuclear deal. I thought we could have negotiated better. The reason why we didn't negotiate better is very complicated, and I don't want to go into that right now. But I was always skeptical, and I was in Vienna at the time, and I told Dr. Zarif that I don't think the Americans will implement the deal. And as we speak, I don't believe we should leave the deal. I think Iran should remain within the deal, but I think Iran's current policy is an appropriate one. The Iranians are pursuing their nuclear program. They're expanding the nuclear program. That's how they gain leverage. And I don't think it should be the Iranians to exit the deal. If anyone's going to exit it, we should let the other side do it. But in order to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans recognize that Iran is not going to wait forever, I think there should be a policy change. And this is where I think the previous administration or the outgoing administration made a mistake. I think the new administration should tilt away from Europe and the United States. We should explore better relations with China, with Russia, with Asia, with the Global South, with regional countries and neighboring countries. They should be our priority. If the Europeans and the Americans want to come back to the table, if they want to come to their senses and implement the deal, fine. I'm not saying that we should break off ties with the Europeans in any way or form. But I'm saying that we should give them a clear message that we're not going to wait anymore and that we're going to engage with those countries that keep their doors open. And if they want to open their doors later on, that's fine. But we can no longer wait. And at the same time, I think that the Iranians are doing the right thing. I think the Iranian parliament passed a more or less good law where the Iranians will fulfill all of their obligations, or let's say they will expand their nuclear program and implement their right to have an extensive peaceful nuclear program within the framework of the NPT and the IAEA. And the regulations in NPT and the IAEA allow Iran to do many things. And I think Iran should explore all of them to the fullest. Mm-hmm. To make the Americans and the Europeans feel the pressure.
Okay. Well, George Samueli, I'm going to get back to you on and test you on some of the things you just said there. But after I asked George Samueli this, George Samueli, we've had some exposure towards the incoming new administration headed by Seyed Ebrahim Raisi. And he has said, you know what, okay, we can continue the talks. But he said that this is not going to make or break Iran. If the U.S. eventually pulls through, great. If not, Iran's going to move on. Do you get that impression?
I do get that impression, and I concur with Professor Miranda's assessment. I mean, it's understandable that Iran wants the U.S. sanctions lifted, but I think it's a hopeless endeavor dealing with the United States. What is important is that the United Nations Security Council sanctions have gone, and they're not coming back, and therefore Iran has a lot more room to maneuver than it did have a decade ago, because as long as it is building a peaceful nuclear energy program within the parameters of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as long as it's cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Authority, then it's going to have good trading relations with Russia, it's going to have good trading and relations with China, and therefore the whole dollar-denominated trading system, which was so painful to Iran, is going to become much less important. Russia is moving away from the dollar. The Chinese are moving away from the dollar. And so Iran will be able to conduct oil trade, without reliance on the dollar.
Okay. So my final question goes to you, Professor Morandi. I don't know if you remember, Joe Biden was almost boarding a plane. And that was when the news came out that Iran signed that deal with China, that big deal. And when the reporter asked him about that, he was very angry. when he responded, yeah, this was in the works and I knew it would happen. Do you think that the U.S. does not, or one of the incentives it has, is it does not want Iran to gravitate towards China in the former manner that that deal showed that it was going to, along with Russia, I'm assuming, and for this to be an incentive for the U.S. to actually want to have a deal with Iran?
The United States can't have its cake and eat it too. On the one hand, they want to impose maximum pressure on Iran, and they want Iran to sit quiet. They also impose sanctions and economic warfare on China, and they want China not to tilt towards Iran. And they impose sanctions on Russia, and they want Russia just to stand still. That's not going to happen, especially because the world is changing very rapidly. Western countries are on the decline. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying that Western countries have no influence, but relatively speaking, they are on the decline. And by putting pressure on Iran, Russia, and China, they are creating a greater incentive for them to work towards each other. And I think it's the smart thing to do. These countries have a vested interest in making sure that the United States fails in its economic warfare. Because if the United States succeeds against Russia, that's a success against everyone. If the United States fails against Iran, that's a failure in its economic warfare against all countries. So it's smart for Iran to have good ties with all countries that want to have good ties with Iran. And if the United States and the Europeans come to their senses, so much the better. But if they don't want to come to their senses, then Iran, while maintaining its independence, Iran is fiercely independent, it will engage in the best of relations with those countries that want to have excellent relations with Iran.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. That's Professor, or Sayyid Mohammad Morandi, Professor of the University of Tehran. Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
And also Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli from Budapest. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitakhovay, the entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're now up to chapter 3 of part 2, and this chapter is talking about how to deal with non-Muslims. And of course, this is a very, very vast topic. It's never going to be something that we would be able to cover in one or two or a few sessions. But Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli points to some very, very important issues that we need to remember as Muslims. We've spoken about mu'mineen, we've spoken about fasiqeen, and now we were going to talk about those who appear to act as they are Muslims, but in reality, deep inside, they are far from that. They appear to have faith in something, but inside they are something else. You know, and that level of fisq, you know, is indeed a very, very low, dangerous level, which is exactly why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sees a munafiq as an enemy. Humul adu fahdharhum, as Surah Al-Munafiqun says. They are the enemies. The munafiqeen are the enemies. So beware of them. Be cautious of them. When you are a mu'min, you need to make sure that you are able to define who a munafiq is. You can pick out who a munafiq is. Do you need to announce who the munafiq is? That's where the difficulty is, because in many, many cases, you know, someone else might not believe you. And but that's also why they're called munafiqs, because a hypocrite is easily able to camouflage himself. And, of course, they're basing their behavior on deceit, on lying, on betrayal, on all of these other evil, very, very vile characteristics. Let me read out very quickly some of these verses that describe who the munafiqeen are. يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهُ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسُهُمْ خُدْعَةً. They're deceitful. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ وَبِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَمَا هُمْ بِمُؤْمِنِينَ. There's some people who say that they believe in Allah and in Judgment Day, but in reality, they are not. اتخذوا أيمانهم جنة فصدوا عن سبيل الله. They think that they have used their faith as a safeguard in order for them to be safe from God. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of course, is well aware of that. They're also very scared of death. فلما كتب عليهم القتال إذا فريق منهم يخشون الناس كخشية الله. You know, they're more scared of people than they are scared of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, you know, they try to conform themselves with the enemy as well. So they are saying that they're Muslim, but in reality, they are supporting or they are aligning themselves with the enemy of Islam, with the enemy of your faith.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for